Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Latin America Review. This is a free weekly episode we do on YouTube. And make sure to sign up on Patreon to get all of our weekly locked episodes as well. And today I wanted to talk about something that I've been thinking about this week in regards to the news we saw about the deportations of right-wing figures who participated in the failed 2018 coup in Nicaragua, and the manner in which the United States has been claiming this as some sort of victory on their part, and the government of Nicaragua has said very clearly that this was not a trade-off, but rather sending mercenaries back to their handlers. And I think it should cause us to reflect, think a little bit about how countries like Nicaragua, like Venezuela, have managed to stave off the worst period of attacks and sanctions regimes that we saw beginning with, especially around 2018, 2019, with the Trump administration. And to talk a little bit about this, we are with Francisco Dominguez, researcher at the Middlesex University, and also secretary of the Venezuela Solidarity Campaign, and has always been a pillar of the movements in solidarity with Latin America there in the UK. Francisco, welcome. And I wanted to, going off this news we're seeing in Nicaragua, can we say that Nicaragua, Venezuela, and others have managed to survive this period of intense attacks that we saw during the Trump administration? They're living to fight another day in the face of the sanctions regimes that we saw at that period. Is the US running out of ideas here?
Well, first of all, thanks very much for inviting me. It's an honor and a pleasure. I think the key to understand this is this. The United States was able to actually overthrow, oust, and defeat electorally as a result of its pressure several countries in the region, several left-wing governments, starting from the one in Honduras in 2009, then Fernando Lugo in Paraguay in 2012, tried nearly successfully a coup d'etat in Ecuador in 2010, and then everybody knows it was behind the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff in 2016, and obviously was training Sergio Moro, the judge that managed to imprison Lula, and there is more, but by 2000, I even was involved in many ways in the 2019 coup d'etat against Evo Morales in Bolivia. So by 2019, 2020, it looked like the United States had recovered the region. The only problem was that Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela were still standing. So in that context of favorable relation of forces for the United States, they launched a massive, massive wave of aggression, particularly against Venezuela, but also against Cuba. And these countries confronted this in the context of the pandemic. Imagine your economy is totally blockaded, and then the pandemic hits you extremely badly. The United States does everything in their power to prevent you from getting medical supplies, food, and everything else, and certainly income. The blockade was total in the case of Venezuela. Nevertheless, the United States was not able to succeed with these three countries. I think the key reason is this. The United States, when it makes a political success, when it wins some, scores some political victory, as they did in what I described, is unable to offer anything to the people. It offers pillage, austerity, neoliberalism, inequities, repression, and certainly military bases. They're not very attractive. And as a consequence, the governments that is able to install in these places by force or by any means are not stable, and they're not able to consolidate the political gains. So therefore, the masses have been inspired by the previous period, the golden decade of the pink tide, come back and were able to defeat very rapidly this government. The comparison I want to make is this. In the case of Chile, when Pinochet waged the coup d'etat on 11th of September 1973, it was massive historic defeat. We're still, you know, fighting to recover our democracy in Chile, and we haven't been able to get back to the agenda sort of framework. Whereas the other countries went back very quickly, in the case of Brazil to Lula, in the case of Bolivia to Rizarce, which is the mass, and so forth. So I think that's the reason. And because of that inability, the United States was not able to defeat, crush Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba. I think particularly in this case must be highlighted the case of Venezuela, that suffered hugely as a consequence of 927 horrible, nasty, cruel sanctions.
Definitely. And also within the region, we could say that governments like Nicaragua, Venezuela, Cuba faced internal enemies. And if we look back to 2019, really the height of this, the so-called ProSur bloc that was created, you had, you know, Iván Duque in Colombia, Mauricio Macri in Argentina, Sebastián Piñera in Chile, and many, many others. And, you know, it felt like Venezuela especially was incredibly isolated during this period. This was also the, you know, the most difficult time economically for Venezuela, when the sanctions had really been tightened. So it all came together to create an incredibly difficult situation. But would you say now that there is a more favorable context in Latin America for Nicaragua, for Venezuela, for Cuba, now that many of those presidents are now no longer in power, now that we have presidents who identify themselves as progressives, with some, including figures such as Gabriel Boric in Chile, to a lesser extent, maybe Gustavo Petro in Peru, who have maintained many of the criticisms that were leveled at Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua by the governments, by the right-wing governments that preceded them. Can we say that this is, that we are facing now a more favorable situation for these countries, or is this still a delicate situation for them?
I mean, there is still the possibility the United States come back with something very nasty, but I think its ability to intervene is significantly limited. Not completely, because it's still powerful. But let me give you an example of the contradictions the United States faces, which give us space. The United States pretty much controls Honduras almost totally. You know, it's got 14 military bases in that country. It runs the people who run, you know, commands the people who run the narco traffic. It runs and has enormous influence over the military forces, the police forces, and the elite there. So the United States had every possibility to actually stop Xiomara Castro from winning the election. The reason why the United States didn't do it is because it was divided internally. Had the right wing won, then you would have had right away a caravan, you know, with thousands and thousands of Hondurans and others making it to the United States, hitting Biden in the face, exploding as an issue in his face, and then giving chances to particularly Trump. And remember, this election took place before the midterm election in November 2022. That's one important thing. Secondly, in the case of Brazil, the United States did not intervene, you know, on the wrong side. They were on the right, on the side of Bolsonaro. And the key reason was Bolsonaro is a strong ally of President Trump, or former President Trump. And the last thing somebody like Biden would like is a President Bolsonaro in a very powerful and influential country such as Brazil. So they didn't do anything that is we know of in order to stop. Normally they do. Normally the ambassador says something. Normally the State Department makes some statement and so on, and they couldn't. But I think in the case of Colombia, I think they didn't know how to stop it. They wanted to stop it. They wanted, you know, to have Duque and Uribismo to continue in that country because they wanted to continue with the maximum pressure on Venezuela. But the mass movement and the ability, the skill of Gustavo Petro to put together a very broad front, very, you know, quite robust electorally at least, And he was able to defeat the extreme forces in Colombia. And the first thing he does, Petro, is, you know, to start collaborating, liaising, normalizing relations, economic, political, and diplomatic relations with Venezuela, which helps enormously, not only the peace process, but also the relationship between the two countries. When it comes to the question of Venezuela, it seems to me that in Venezuela, what you have is specifically different state. In Brazil, in 2016, all the way to 2020, the United States and the right wing were able to actually get rid of the Workers' Party government, because the Workers' Party government was so successful that it stopped mobilizing the masses. I mean, this is quite a compact idea, but they stopped mobilizing the masses. They concentrated much more on parliamentary maneuvers. By demobilizing their masses, their mass base, when it came to the question of them being hit by a way of counteroffensive, they couldn't defend themselves. Whereas in Venezuela, the opposite was the case, and the opposite is the case. What you have is thousands and thousands of grassroots committees organized at every level. You know, the mobilization, the permanent mobilization of them is always there. That you have the militia, you have the armed forces, which is quite important in the civil military alliance with the government, which has limited the possibility of the United States. I think that's why they were defeated. And the situation is very favorable in the following sense. Number one, in 2021, Venezuela grew by 17.7%, nearly 18%. And in 2022, Venezuela's economy grew by nearly 16%. Obviously, they started from a very low base, but now the situation is much, much better. There is even the situation that Biden is being compelled to go to send a delegation, hat in hand, to talk to President Maduro, a government that they are supposed not to recognize, to explore possibilities for Venezuela to begin to sell oil to the world market. And the basic reason for this is that the United States needs desperately that there is more oil supply in the world economy because of the consequences of the Ukraine war, so that the price of oil declines. And so therefore, in that sense, it's very positive. But more importantly than that is the CELAC, the Commonwealth of Latin American and Caribbean States 7 Summit, where they met, you know, recently. Their commitment to regional integration is very strong. Already, Lula talked to Alberto Fernandez, president of Argentina, to set up a single currency. Lula, during the electoral campaign, made the point that he said he was made a mistake by not taking Hugo Chavez's proposal to create a single currency and a Bank of the South seriously. And the consequence was the dollarization of the world market, you know, limits our possibilities of recovery. So now that Brazil has joined the equation of the left-wing governments of different shades, of course, this commitment is very serious. This single currency is very good. And finally, the regional integration is very strong, but also the maneuver that the United States organized recently to send various delegates and even mobilize Scholz, you know, the German chancellor, to try to persuade the Latin American countries to get rid of some of the old equipment to be donated to Ukraine so that they could replace that equipment with United States military equipment, which was completely rejected. So the conditions now exist, which are very, very positive for Latin America to retake what I would call a second pink tie, not identical, but very similar to the one that took place between 1998 to 2014-16. And we have two advantages. Number one, the United States is weaker and we are wiser because we know what not to do and what mistakes not to make. So I think the position is very good.
Yeah, and you touched on the issue of the United States sending delegations to Venezuela. There was a, you know, a big fanfare in the news, I remember, about perhaps 6 months ago. Since then, we haven't really heard much. And a question people always ask me is, on what conditions do you think Venezuela will be willing you know, make a deal with the United States? What would Venezuela need, or what guarantees would Venezuela need for its own sovereignty and democracy? What do you think they are putting to the United States in these meetings, and how possible do you think it is for a rapprochement here?
Well, the United States, Biden has made the decision to, this is complicated because he's not quite lifting the sanction, but he's allowed Chevron that continue to be operating in Venezuela, even when there was no extraction of any oil whatsoever. Allowed Chevron, gave Chevron special licenses to extract Venezuelan oil, which obviously had to pay to Venezuela, to supply particularly the European market. And this was a license given by Biden for 6 months. And the conversations have been taking place, you know, God knows exactly what is being discussed. But I think there is a manifestation, one incident that took place. The United States kidnapped Special Envoy, Venezuelan Special Envoy Alex Saab, who is in prison now in Florida. He was arrested legally in Cape Verde. He was extradited to Florida without Cape Verde having an extradition treaty with the United States. And he's been charged with money laundering in the United States when this guy was arrested in Cape Verde. So as soon as that happened, Maduro said that he was not prepared to continue with the dialogue with the opposition, particularly the white opposition, which is the one they recognize. And, you know, that stopped completely. So I think Maduro has made the point recently like this. He said, we're ready to normalize relations with the United States completely, provided that this is based on mutual respect. And every time the United States tries to pull off a fast one on Venezuela, Venezuela resists and objects and denounces the United States. The activity, the diplomatic activity of Venezuela in the United Nations is enormous, it's huge. It's particularly denouncing the sanctions system and the sanctions regime of the United States against 39 countries. The number of initiatives through the non-aligned movement to the G77 plus China, through, you know, various other bodies of the United Nations is gigantic, is enormous, and is very influential. Unfortunately, we here in the West, I should call it like that, don't hear about this. So Venezuela is making no concessions whatsoever, but it's prepared to be pragmatic. If the United States want oil, no problem. And I think this applies also to Cuba. Cuba just reestablished ambassadors, you know, between the United States and Cuba. Cuba is suffering much more because, not only because of the sanctions regime, but because the tourism industry collapsed by 96% as a consequence of the pandemic. But now the situation is recovering. So I don't think we need to worry about that. Venezuela is being recovering economically, and the Maduro government is completely in charge.
Yes, and if we look at the past year and the attacks that have come from within Latin America, at Nicaragua, at Venezuela, at Cuba, I would say the loudest voice has not even been some of the Russian governments like President Bolsonaro or the governments of Uruguay or Paraguay that still have conservative administrations. But one of the loudest voices has been Gabriel Boric in Chile, who was elected on a progressive vote with a progressive alliance, which included as well the Communist Party of Chile. However, he has been one of the leading voices of attacks on Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua. And Francisco, you are yourself Chilean. And how would
I am. Nobody's perfect.
No, of course. How would you evaluate this past year of Gabriel Boric? Because when we look at the coverage, especially outside, we hear very, very little about his domestic agenda. We hear almost some of the only news that comes out of Chile is his attacks against Venezuela and Cuba. But how are people in Chile evaluating his gestión, his rule this past year, and if he has lived up to the campaign promises and the ideals that were brought out in what was a very positive campaign at the time How's things going now?
Yeah, let me clear one thing out first. These people who have been, as the media call it, deported from Nicaragua, I mentioned this because it's relevant in regarding your question. These people committed crimes. They are not political prisoners. There are politicians who happen to be in prison because they committed crimes. Some of the crimes were very serious. If you look at the legislation in the United States and the UK, which I've done, in order to make a comparison, if you were to be receiving money from a foreign country and organize a violent attempt to overthrow the existing government, you will be charged with sedition. And in the United States, this carries the death penalty or anything between that and 5 years in prison. In the case of the United Kingdom, it's very similar. You can get minimum 5 years and anything up to 30 or even more years. So these people actually committed crimes. And as a consequence of this, they were in prison for convicted of 20 years, 30 years, 25 years, and so on. And the government of Daniel Ortega, which is a national reconciliation government, wants to have peace in his country. So a very good measure is to actually ensure that these people actually are not in prison. They are free, but somewhere else. And he made a clear point. He said, we proposed to the United States through our chancellor, to our foreign minister. And it was a purely, he called it more or less bureaucratic operation. There was no political discussion. He said, are you willing to take them? We'll send them to you. And the United States was prepared to take all of them except two. And the total was 222. So all these stories in the media and so on are complete, nonsense. It's just spin by the media, by the right-wing media. Now, Boric is a very peculiar character. It's peculiar because my sense is that he wants to portray, he wants to project an image of himself as somebody who is above the normal left-right division that exists in Latin America. And he has this particular mantra, which is, I'm quite prepared to condemn, human rights abuses in left-wing governments as well as human rights abuses in right-wing countries and right-wing governments. He hasn't said too much about, repression in right-wing governments. He did support initially the overthrow of Pedro Castillo. He thought it was constitutional to have, to have him ousted, which is later on, he changed his tune a little bit. This is my sense. I think he was elected president by default. The candidate should have been Daniel Jadue, but because of the way they organized the primaries, he became president. Up to the point when the Constitutional Convention was organizing, preparing the text, the constitutional text that was put to the referendum to the population last year, up to that point, the masses had a political leadership, which was the Constitutional Convention. Everything actually went into that. All the demands, all the aspirations, all the discussions, everything went there. And they took also the proposal from, social organizations, social bodies, associations of every imaginable kind. So it provided a de facto political leadership of the rebellion that began the year before. But when that ended and the document was presented, to the population, that thing that was providing de facto leadership, the Constitutional Convention, dispersed. And these people did not create anything alternative, such as, the Libre organization in Honduras, or some such as a broad front of any kind. And everything that's been taking place ever since has been ad hoc. So between that moment, when the text was actually out, and the dispersal took place, and the actual referendum, Boric didn't do anything in form of campaigning. He did not campaign. The left more or less did not campaign. The right-wing media and the right-wing, which orchestrated this, went on the rampage, denouncing, creating a situation of chaos that if these texts was to be voted on, then, you know, the country will go into total chaos. There will be terrible situation. It will be, we will go back to the crisis before Allende and so on and so forth. People believe this. For example, the lies that the media told was that anybody, you know, would be more or less compelled to have abortions. Their children might be in charge of the state rather than in charge of their parents. These are the lies. And there was no counter attack. There was no countering of this campaign. And in that period, there were two things that happened, which I think are symptomatic of Boric. Number one, he, in the middle of this campaign that the right wing was waging, Boric actually had a one-to-one meeting with Zelensky. Whatever you may think about Zelensky, whatever anybody may think about the Ukraine in Chile, why on earth bring Zelensky and the Ukraine war in the middle of the referendum, which is about Chilean matters, indigenous matters, you know, working class, wages, private stuff, and so on? That's number one. And number two, in that period, Antonia Urrejola, who is his foreign minister, went to Spain for no reason whatsoever, apparently, and then met with the foreign minister of Spain. They made a joint statement demanding anticipated presidential elections in Venezuela. I was thinking, what on earth is he trying to do? So what happened was that the right wing actually covered the day in the following manner, which is interesting to examine. Boric won with 4.6 million votes when he won the election as a president, one of the largest votes ever for any president in the history of Chile. But when it came to the question of the constitutional text that was defeated, the constitutional text actually got 4.8 million votes. So we didn't lose any votes in that sense. The problem was that the election of Boric took place under the context, the law which made the vote voluntary. And there is about 30% of the electorate that hasn't voted historically in Chile ever since they made the vote voluntary. And when it came to the question of the referendum, then they changed the law and they made the vote compulsory. And that 30% voted. And because we didn't fight, you know, the left did not fight, did not wage a campaign, did not promote the text, did not do anything. The campaign was extremely weak, if at all. Then the consequence of that was the right wing was able to actually capitalize and capture that depoliticized section of society that was subjected to this massive campaign. In other words, it's a failure of leadership. It's our Achilles heel in Chile, which we haven't got leadership. My sense is that at the end of the day, Boric is not very progressive and equivocates every time he can. On the other hand, I've noticed that presidents López Obrador, Luis Arce, López Obrador in Mexico, Luis Arce in Bolivia, and a few others, including Gustavo Petro, are sort of courting him to ensure that they're moving in the right direction. So I'm hoping that this new wave of regional integration, where they're going to be together, you know, the left-wing presidents much more than now, and much more than up to now, then it will be possible to influence him in the right direction. Because his problem is this: if he doesn't deliver what the masses wanted, he's not going to be re-elected. And as a consequence of that, the right wing is going to be elected. I'm not sure, I'm sure that he doesn't want that. So he would like to be re-elected. So unless he does the right thing, including, you know, identifying himself with the progressive forces and the progressive processes in the rest of the continent, when there is no reason not to, he's going to suffer the consequences. He's already getting a bit discredited. I'm myself pretty disappointed.
Well, thank you so much, Francisco, for the analysis of the situation, of the context in Latin America, the balance of power in our region. And thank you for joining us here on Latin America Review. We hope to have you back as well at some point. And yeah, that will wrap it up for this week's episode. Thank you so much, Francisco.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for the invitation. Anytime. I'm ready to do it.